text we pray the Lord be pleased to speak to us from is the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew's Gospel, chapter 6, verses 19 through 24. Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24. I want to speak today on the theme, treasuring your treasures. Treasuring your treasures. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Was Jesus making a recommendation, or was he suggesting to those who want to grow in spiritual maturity how they might do so, or was he issuing a command? Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on this earth. By observation of how most of us live, I must say that we would answer that Jesus was only making a recommendation and not a command. Why do I say this? Because of the preponderance of evidence that proves we obviously do not take our Lord's command as a command. We live as if there is no afterlife. We live as if there's no death. We live as if the earth is the only source of joy and peace and happiness. We simply do not take our Lord seriously. And I wonder if we should even call Him Lord, since we do not obey this command. This command is balanced with another. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Now, what does it mean to lay up treasures in heaven? How do you send your money ahead or your possessions ahead? How do you do that? What does that mean? Now, many scholars and theologians believe that at this point in the Sermon on the Mount that we have a shift, a change, that he is no longer dealing with the deep theological issues of the first chapter 5 and the first half of chapter 6. Now he has transitioned to a more practical part of his message, where the application has been made, where he's dealing with real life issues and showing us how to do so. I will not argue that we are now embarking on more practical, more practical suggestion or commands. More practical application. But I would argue strongly that there is no transition here. That Jesus is not changing his approach or his material. If you follow the major theme of this sermon, you will see he is continuing with it as before. If you look at the first half of chapter 6, what we have covered already, Jesus has dealt with some very spiritual issues and spiritual things. Giving to the poor, praying, fasting. But he has not changed his emphasis or his instruction. He is continuing by saying, if you place this earth as your premium, as the place where your treasures are, well, you're doing the very same thing as praying so that people can hear you. Giving so that people can see. Fasting so that people might notice that you're a holy person. You see, the reason you give and pray and fast so that others can see is because you treasure this present age and not heaven. So no, he is not changing what he's doing here. He's just now moving to things that we would call more practical. But nothing can be more practical to your Christian life than praying and fasting and giving. Well, let's look at this morning for a few moments, shall we? I want to direct your attention to the practical wisdom that we see here. There's a practical reason that Jesus gives us for not investing in earthly treasures, and it is this reason, verse 19. Earthly treasures are subject to loss. They do not last. Verse 19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Jesus gives us some reasons for loss on this earth. Natural deterioration. Insects. Natural deterioration of just time. Rust. All of these factors play in to the loss of physical things. There are natural disasters as well. We do not need to elaborate on that, do we? We have witnessed firsthand people who have lost their homes and everything they had invested in a few short days. All that they had was gone. If you invest in this earth, your investment will eventually be lost. There is no exception. And not only is natural deterioration or disasters a problem, Jesus said there are unnatural reasons. People breaking in called thieves who will interrupt your sleep or come in when you're gone and take everything you have. But then there are thieves that are of a more deceptive nature. They don't break in and steal. They deceive. They take people for scams and rob them that way. The Bernie Madoffs of the world. How many people had invested their life savings with that man, on the verge of perhaps retiring, and now it's all gone, and instead of retiring, they have to continue on in the workforce. That's a thief. And then there are just the ups and downs of the financial market and economics. Those of us who had any type of retirement, investment, 401ks or the like, learned what can happen in just a short matter of time. Most 401ks, for example, suffered 40% loss in just a matter of days. And much of that has not yet been regained. So Jesus has given you a practical advice here. You don't want to invest on earth because it may pay off in the short term, but in the long term, you lose. You can't take it with you. But it's just not money we're talking about here. All, please listen, all physical pleasures wear out. With each successive enjoyment of whatever the pleasure might be, the excitement becomes less and less. It doesn't matter if it's a relationship with someone, if it's shopping, or if it's golfing. It matters not what the pleasure is, if it's entertainment or some kind of a hobby. The more you do it, the less excitement you get from it. And so, like a narcotic, the thrill of the high becomes less and less, requiring stronger dosage or even a stronger drug. That's the way all pleasures are in this world. Ross Gittins is the chief economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. He said this about why happiness will not last. Very insightful. Listen closely. We get an initial surge of pleasure from a pay raise or from winning a car in a raffle. But it never lasts long. What at first was new and wonderful soon becomes what we're used to and have come to expect. That thus do yesterday's luxuries become today's necessities. But as survey evidence confirms, most of us remain convinced that a little more money would make us happier, even though it never has before. Psychologists call this phenomenon the hedonic treadmill. We keep striving for more money, but it never delivers any lasting increase in our happiness. He's right. Two things that he says that are very insightful. That whatever is new today and is a luxury will be tomorrow's necessity. How many things do you have in your life that you call a necessity, but the truth is they're really a luxury? How about a cell phone, for example? Or the microwave? How many of you would choose willingly to quit, to give away your microwave or your cell phone? Oh, you might when they're not working properly. But the truth is, we don't need either of the two. We can get along and survive without either. But we don't want to. Why? Because what was a luxury has now become a necessity to us. And by the way, secondly, he's right, because how many of you ever longed for that pay raise and you finally got it? How much longer was it before you were yearning for the next one? You see, pleasures wear out. Doesn't matter what the pleasure. I sometimes think I have to preach and try a little harder because the pleasure of listening to me can wear out. But that's just the way earthly pleasures are, no matter what they are. Robert Burns said it well in his poem, "But pleasures are like poppies spread. You seize the flower, its bloom is shed. Or like the snow falls in the river, a moment white, then melts forever." But then Jesus gives us another practical reason for investing in heavenly treasures. They are not subject to loss. They last. Verse 20. "But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal." Now friends, how many of you are really paying attention to what you are hearing in this moment and saying to yourself, "I've got to do some major changing"? This is real investment advice. Or should I say, investment commands. From a purely investment strategy, one is good and the other is not. One is a sure thing, the other is a sure thing as well. It's a sure loss. Some of you will never have the reason to talk to an investment broker or advisor, while some of you do on a repeated basis. But to all of you, let me give you some investment insight. God has given you something much more valuable to invest than stocks and bonds or money. He has given you life and time. How are you investing those things? The question is not, please listen, are you investing? That's not the question. Because we all invest. You either invest in earth or you invest in heaven. The question is not, are you investing? But the question is, which one are you investing in? And Jesus makes it very clear. If you want to gain, heaven's the place you need to move your treasures. But then secondly, there is a deeper spiritual reality for us to look at this morning, and I want to unpack it for the remainder of our time. Verse 21. It is perhaps the most important verse, no doubt about it, of this text, and perhaps the most important verse of the whole sermon. I think it would come second to the theme that we've already established, the theme being that your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. And here is what Jesus said, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." I don't need to expound on this text. I don't need to unpack it or explain it. You know it to be true. The heart follows its ruling desires. Always has, always will. You're made that way. You do know that, don't you? It's not a matter of choice. It's a matter of nature. You will always go for the ruling desires of your life. Your heart is ruled by those, and it will follow. So the question this morning is this. This is where wise investment begins. You ask yourself, what is my ruling desire? What is ruling my heart? What desire has conquered it and has its devotion? Well, here's the answer. It's what you treasure the most. What you treasure the most. It might be a husband or a wife, a son or a daughter, a mother or a father. It might be your job. It might be security. It might be just plain old comfort. What do you treasure? Well, there's your ruling desire, and it does rule your heart. Now, please pay attention. Jesus is speaking not to lost people. He's speaking primarily to Christians, mainly to His own disciples. And He says to them, where are you investing? Where is your heart? Where are your ruling desires? There's your treasure. There's where your investment is. Now, He says this to Christians because Jesus knows that the natural desires of the flesh are fastened, riveted upon the temporal things of this world. We're not talking about spiritual desires yet. We're talking about the natural desires of the mind and of this body, which can rule the heart of every believer in this room. It is willful ignorance to presume or believe that somehow you as a Christian never have to battle the flesh and its desires. That somehow because you are a Christian, you're above that. My dear friend, that's what the devil wants you to believe. The devil wants you to believe that you're above battling these things, that you ought to be further down the road than that, that your progress ought to be, you're not even enticed. Come now, you are a Christian. Christians don't deal with this. Christians have spiritual desires. Well, they do, but they also have fleshly desires, every one of us. And most often, these fleshly desires fasten themselves not on godly things, but on temporal things. And so Jesus is saying something here. He's giving you an insight that you can cultivate your desires. He tells you don't lay up treasures on earth. Why would He say that? Evidently, some of these men's treasures were on this earth. And He's telling them, now lay up for treasures in heaven. You have a choice. You have an investment choice. Evidently, we can choose and we can cultivate the desires of the heart. Your heart's going to be ruled by a desire, but you can have input. Thank God. Otherwise, we would be mere creatures like the animal kingdom, ruled by instinct alone. We can cultivate our desires. They can become stronger or weaker depending on our cultivation of them. This is not automatic. Just because you are a Christian doesn't mean you're just going to be taken away and carried along by spiritual desires. The reason sometimes, in fact, that natural desires seem stronger than spiritual desires is because there's a bodily connection to these desires with our emotions. And I need to unpack that for a few moments. You see, the desires of the flesh are all rooted in the body and the mind, part of the body. They're all rooted there. All of your appetites, all of your desires, all of your natural propensities are rooted within this body. Therefore, there is a strong connection with the bodies and the physical emotions because they're coming from the same place. You can feel the titillation of desires in your body. Can't you not? Haven't you felt the excitement producing a rush, tingly sensation, warm flushes? These desires seem to take over body and soul. And before we know it, we're carried along with that thing. But spiritual desires can also produce spiritual feelings. Yes, they can. What God works in your heart can literally be felt in the body by the emotions. Now, I don't wait around for that. In fact, sometimes, most often, I don't have those emotions, those physical sensations. What do? You cultivate godly desires. And the desire that rules always depends on the desire you've cultivated. Let me give you an example. With the object of love, or the subject, I should say. Do you know that you learn to love people? Oh, yes, it's true. Whatever connection you might have felt with that person and called it love, please hear me, that's not love. Otherwise, marriages would never end. Children and parents would continue on in it. But that's not the way it works, is it? The initial rush, the initial feeling, we can all boil them down to just simply hormonal. No, love is a decision that is made. It always is. And I want to say that most of us that's in this room, doesn't mean it has to be this way, but the statistics would bear it out, that most of us really didn't love our spouse when we married them. And if we do today, it's because we've learned to love them. Feelings do not last. And once the feeling leaves, you're left with one thing, the decision to love or not love. And if you love them, then you value or treasure them, you delight in them because you've chosen to learn to love them. I know this is true. I've said it to many people. I've had to use this example twice this week, that when I married Karen, I did not love her. I lusted after her, but I really didn't love her. Not the kind of love that we ought to love. Not the kind of love that I have now. And where did that kind of love come from? It came one day, I can tell you. I remember that day strongly. Once after I was converted, but secondly, even after my conversion, there was a deep frustration in my heart. My wife just doesn't always do what I want her to do. That's hard for some of you to believe that know her. She just doesn't. You know what my expectations of her are, or were? Perfection. She couldn't do that. No more than your spouse can please you perfectly all the time. And there was a day on my knees when I cried out to God, and God gave me an understanding of truth. Not a feeling, but of truth. What was that truth, Pastor? Here's what it was. That God loves me when I'm not imperfect, which means He loves me all the time. Because He chooses to. Not because He has warm fuzzies for me, but because He chooses to love. God's love is much deeper than warm fuzzies. And that's the way I'm to love her. And do you know what happens when you choose to love a person for who they are? You have to learn to do that, dear friend. And it takes time. But when it does, the love is much deeper than any feeling in courtship. It's much broader and sustaining than anything you experienced before your wedding day. But you have to cultivate that. And this is the same thing that Jesus is telling. That's what investing in heaven is all about. You cultivating the desires that ought to rule the heart and ought to be centered in God. So I can say it this way. If I choose to love God, I'm choosing to value Him, to treasure, and to delight in Him. I'm choosing to learn to love God. Now that may seem contrary to somebody's theology. Did I learn to love God? Well, dear friend, it is not contrary. Why the commands, therefore, to love God with all of our heart? If it was automatic. Oh, yes, there's a love in my heart for Him given to me by grace at the moment that I was saved. But that has to be cultivated, just as it does with a marriage. Why? Because, and this is what Jesus tells us in verse 22 and 23, the heart can see or be blinded to God's Word. That's why this has to be cultivated. The heart can see or cannot see God's worth. Verse 22 and 23. Jesus gives us two illustrations to substantiate what He says in verses 19 through 21. He says, "The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now, what do you mean? I don't understand. Light, darkness, how can light be dark? Now, Jesus says so. What does he mean here? Here's the illustration unpacked. The eye lets in light. And light by the optic nerve gives the brain the ability to see, to perceive, to discern. And so the brain discerns light so that you can maneuver in your environment through the eye. If your eyes are good, you see clearly. And your body's not trapped in the darkness of blindness. But Jesus is saying something else here. Jesus uses a wordplay here. The word for good, if your eye is good, literally should be translated single. If your eye is single. The word means to take a piece of cloth and spread it out without any folds. It's not doubled, but singled. This is a metaphor for the heart. Not really, not the eye, but the heart. The heart should be single, undivided, no folds. It's single, laid out clearly. The illustration is, if your heart is single in treasuring God, then you will live in God's light. You'll see Him clearly. If you see Him clearly, you will appraise Him, and prize Him for the value He is. The infinite value that He is. Your heart will be ruled by that. So the heart can either see the glory of God or it can be blinded to the glory of God. If you value other things, then your heart is blinded to the worth of God, and it is in a blindness, a darkness, that's called the darkness of this world. And the darkness of this world portrays itself to you as being light. But it's not really light. It's darkness. And oh, how the world portrays itself as light, doesn't it? Just turn on the television any time of day and watch just anything for 10 or 15 minutes and you will see what I'm talking about. How good, how wholesome, how beneficial, how advantageous their products, their lifestyle, their philosophy is. How many times have we been drawn in by those lies of darkness to think it was the way to go? It was light. So Jesus illustrates this. A good eye is to love God. It's to see that God is much more valuable than anything on this earth, and a bad eye cannot see that. It's blinded by the lure of this world. Then he illustrates again, using the same principle, but this time with two masters. Why? Because the heart can have only one ruling desire at a time. Your heart can only be ruled by one thing at one time. You can have many desires at the same time, but one will rule them all. Look at verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Why did he stick that onto the end? Why does he add this illustration? Because if he had stopped there with just the eyes, somebody would have said, you know, seeing double is not a bad thing after all. I can have both. To not be single in eye, but double in vision. Well, you've had maybe that experience where everything you looked at was kind of like you saw two of everything. But Jesus says, no. You cannot have two equally competing desires. You will love one and you will despise the other. Because the heart can only be ruled by one desire that rules, outrules them all. Look at verse 21. Now 24. He or she who would try to have the best of both worlds will find they cannot do so. Because the heart will not be divided when it comes to first priorities, first love, supreme joy. It's impossible to have two kings, two masters, two lords. Now, what I want us to do before we end is connect the dots. Notice that Jesus makes several comparisons here, beginning in verse 19. Investing on the earth, investing in heaven. Good eye, bad eye. Two masters. Serving God, serving money. And if you look at this, they're all the same. A good eye versus a bad eye is the same thing as one master versus another master, which is the same thing as serving God or serving money, which is in the end the same thing as verse 19 and 20, storing treasure in earth or storing it in heaven. It's the same principle all the way through. Laying up treasures on earth is the same thing as serving money. Laying up treasures in heaven is the same thing as serving God. So therefore, please listen. I have only one deduction to make from that. If I am laying up treasures on this earth, if my hope of joy, comfort, security, all the things that are important to us, is based upon something on this earth, then the truth is, I am not a servant of God. I may carry the title pastor. I may appear to be very spiritual to you. But if my heart is ruled by things of this earth, I cannot serve God. I am not serving God. This is all a farce. And I am greatly deceived. Jesus makes it absolutely clear. Laying up treasures in heaven is serving God. Laying up treasures on earth is not serving God. Serving God or money is to love the one served. If my heart is in love with the material, then it's because the material is my true treasure. That's the problem. That's my master. If my heart is in love with God, it's because He, although unseen, is more valuable than anything that I can see. God is my kingdom and my treasure. Now, I want you to look at verse 19 again. Do not lay up treasures for yourselves on earth. That is a good translation. But it's not the best. It doesn't really say with the punch and power that the disciples probably would have heard it. So let me do this. Let me give you the literal rendition of verse 19. Here's what Jesus is saying. Do you see the word, do not lay up for yourselves? And the word treasures, they are the exact same word. The word lay up or store in some of your translations, do not store up for yourselves treasures on the word store and treasure is the exact same word. So what Jesus is saying is this, do not treasure your treasures on earth. Do not treasure your treasures on earth. Treasure your treasures in heaven. Because there's people who will hear the words of Jesus, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, but lay them up in heaven. And they will do a lot of religious things. They will give. They will even take vows of poverty, thinking they're laying up treasures in heaven. This is not about giving money. This is about what's ruling your heart. And Jesus is saying, don't treasure your treasures on this earth. Treasure the treasures in heaven. Now, why say it that way? Well, simple. Most of us have treasures on this earth, don't we not? There's some things we consider valuable. And if not, let me go out to the car parking lot and choose one of the vehicles I like best and see how you feel if I drive off with it. There are things that we do have that we consider very valuable on this earth. We often look at Peter, James, and John and the other disciples and think, those poor fishermen. That is not quite historically accurate. To be a tradesman in the days of Jesus meant you were probably middle class. You had your aristocracy, the very rich, and then you had your very poor But there was a small middle class. It was people who had skills that they could work as independent contractors. Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, they had their own fishing business. They were better than just poor. They had a business, they had boats, they had nets, they had homes. Remember, Jesus was in Peter's home where he healed his mother-in-law. Remember what Peter said? We have left houses and land and families to follow you. Peter was not poor by the standard of his day. And so Jesus looks to Peter, James, John, Andrew, and some of the others, like Matthew, who was very wealthy, having been an ex-tax collector. He says, hey, it's not wrong to have wealth. It's not wrong to have possessions. Just don't treasure your treasures. Treasure your treasures in heaven. Because your heart will be ruled by one or the other. Jesus is not concerned here about your material possessions. He's concerned about your attitude concerning them. Where's your heart? So, you see, this really has nothing to do with money or possession. It's an exposé of how we think, how we feel about the things that we do presently possess. But it's more than that. It's an exposé about you, how you feel and think about this present life versus what's coming when we die. You see, you can be very poor and still treasure money. Or you can be very wealthy and not treasure it. This is not a command against having wealth. It's a serious call to heed our minds and our hearts concerning what we can see. And to invest in what you cannot see. This is a very powerful strategy of investment. If a life insurance salesman comes to talk to you and tries to show you a product that is an investment, he has to sell you something that's not tangible, doesn't he not? He can't. It's not a car. It's not a computer. It's an intangible product. It's an abstract thought. Peace and security in latter years or in the case of death. And yet people will take out life insurance policies and these other kinds of investment vehicles on things they cannot see. Jesus is not asking you to do anything different. You can't see heaven, you can't see God, but he's saying they are treasures nonetheless. Now he's given you a most powerful strategy to cultivate treasuring your treasures in heaven and to treasure less your treasures on earth. Here's what he's saying to you. The way you do this is by investing more in heaven than in earth. Let me say that again. The investment strategy that Christ is offering you is this. Here's how you treasure less the things that you have on this earth and treasure more the things of heaven is by investing there. In other words, if you will start serving God, not your money. When you will be led by your heart to love God and treasure and value Him, to pray to the glory of God, to fast to the glory of God, and to give to the glory of God, there's where your heart's going to be. So what do? Simple. You give. With the expectation that everything that is given, not just money, but your life is invested and you cannot lose. But if you invest here, you'll lose it all. I want to conclude by saying something that might seem strong or even harsh, but it isn't. We believe what we can see is more important than what we cannot see. That's the whole issue. It is the sad fact that many Christians find it much easier to invest in what they can see than what these eyes cannot see. Have you noticed a repeated phrase in chapter 6? Let me bring it to your attention. It's the phrase, "Your Father who is in secret." Why does he keep saying that? He says that about almsgiving, praying, fasting. Why does he say that those three times? He actually says it more than three times. Because he's wanting to get you to understand that the most important things about life are things you cannot see. God is invisible. He's in the secret place. You can't see Him. You can't point and say, there He is. But He's there nonetheless, and He's real. So the problem is, can I say it this way? You really don't believe in heaven. Oh, you know it exists. But we just don't believe we're going there when we die, because we don't ever expect to die. Now, I'm using the word believe very loosely. I want to use it this way. To be moved with deep conviction. Oh, you believe it exists. You know you're going to die. But you're not moved with deep conviction about this. You believe in heaven, but heaven doesn't deeply move you with its certainty and you go in there. Let me tell you what you should be experiencing this morning. You ought to be anticipating heaven as much, if not more, than the vacation you're going to have this summer. I love when people get near vacations, how they start talking about it, how they start planning about it, how they just, I mean, you talk to them and here you go. It's about where they're going. I mean, it's a really nice vacation. There's going to be a nice area, and you hear about it. You even get phone calls from people who are on vacation who brag about where they are, trying to make you feel a little bit down. Only one person in this audience knows who and or what I'm talking about. We get excited about this. Why? Because it's real to us. We believe it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. I'm going to die. Good news. You're going to die. And if you're a Christian, that is excellent news. Because what happens at the moment of death is far better than anything that could happen in the height of health. But do you believe that? Is that a reality? Is there a deep conviction moving you in that direction? How do you do that? How do you get that to happen? By cultivating the truth and the reality of heaven and Christ and His glories that will be shared with you. You have to do this in the mind. It has to be rehearsed. It has to be renewed. It has to be believed. It has to be thought about. I would subscribe to everyone this prescription. Get up every day and remember, this could be your very last day. Do that every day. Do it several times through the day, and you will begin to feel your heart weaning away from the things of this earth and drawing closer to heaven, because death becomes a reality, and therefore heaven will become a reality. We got to think about these things. We need to live as if they're true, because they are true. The problem now is we're living in a fantasy world. We're believing in lies, and we're believing the truth doesn't really exist, that the truth is the lie. Come now. Wake up out of this sleepy dream that is nothing real and come to the reality of Jesus Christ and all that He's preparing for us. For I want you to know that Jesus believes in you. No, not in the way some of these charlatans are trying to convince people. But He believed in you when you were in the secret place. In other words, you were invisible. In fact, you didn't even exist yet. But He believed in you, and He believed when the Father, when He spoke of you and asked Him to come and give His life for you. He was willing to invest His life for you and in you. Do you hear that? You didn't even exist yet, and yet the Father, you were unreal, unseen, not unreal, unseen to Him. You did not exist yet, but He believed in you. You were real to Him. There was a reality about you and your predicament. And he was willing to come and invest his life for you. Here's my question, and this is, and I'll be done. Are you willing to invest in him? Will he be the treasure you treasure? Because you're going to treasure some of your treasures more than others. Will he be the treasure you invest in because you treasure him more than all of your other treasures? Amen.